My whole thing is fun, man. You know, and it's like if it sounds like a like you said, maybe it's clickbait, but I just feel like if somebody gives me a matrix, if I see a matrix, it's over. If I see a matrix, that's it.
Welcome to episode 75 of the Bay Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. LemurMusic.com, everything you need for the double bass can be found at LemurMusic.com. If you've checked out the recent episodes, the Live from Lemur series, those are a lot of fun. I always enjoy being down there at Lemur and connecting with the folks down there, playing through the basses in their showroom. I think the last time I was down there, I was playing Ron Carter's road bass that they have and converted into a flyaway for him. I remember playing that bass and just being like, yeah, this seems like Ron Carter's bass. Like I've never played another one of Ron Carter's basses, but yeah, this makes sense that this is Ron Carter's bass. Always love being down there. Stop by LemurMusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. Without a doubt, my favorite cables on the market are Tsunami cables. They come with a lifetime guarantee. That's right. Buy the cable one time. Something goes wrong with it, talk to the folks over at Tsunami. They'll switch it out. Buy the cable once. Buy a Tsunami cable. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. If you're like me and you bring upright and electric to the same gig, huh? You're doing some doubling? Check out the Trickfish Trilobite AB box and preamp. I love it. I love it. I use it all the time. Fantastic preamp. I also use their single channel preamp, the Minnow. I use that more for the home recording stuff that I do. But live, I use the Trickfish Trilobite exclusively. Check it out, trickfishamps.com. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. On the episode is New York bassist Lauren Cohen. Lauren is an active member of the New York jazz scene. He has performed with Aaron Goldberg, Adam Rogers, Bucky Pizzarelli, Clarence Penn, Dave Binney, Houston Person, Jim Riddle, Joe LaBarbera, Joe Locke, Johnny Griffith, John Faddis, Monty Alexander, Regina Carter, Steve Wilson's. Like, the list is deep. The list is deep, but you get it. Like, he can play, and he's playing with the cats who can play. Lauren also has an album out titled Home. I highly recommend checking that out. I'll have links to it at thebassshed.com/podcast/Lauren Cohen. Along with some information about the bass boot camp Lauren spearheads, which is a really thoughtful approach to jazz education. Lauren and I discuss how information about a jazz education can sometimes be presented in a way that may be overwhelming or sometimes like backwards. They give you all this information when you're just starting out and learning jazz. And it's like, okay, cool. Now what do I do with it? I really like Lauren's approach, which is it's like a softer approach. Like, hey, don't get all into that right away. It doesn't have to be this heavy, theorized, heavy academic thing. Let's just start with melodies and let's just keep it fun. I really like his approach to it. I had a great time connecting with Lauren. And I can say without a doubt, this is the most I've ever talked about pizza on a podcast episode. And that's what you're walking into, so to speak, at the top of this conversation. here's my chat with New York bassist Lauren Cohen.
How you doing, man? Nice to meet you.
Doing well, man. Nice to meet you too. What are you up to? What are you up to today?
What am I up to? I am getting ready for a gig I have Friday that I'm leading my own group, which is always gotta get my tunes together and all that stuff for dust to make sure I can play my own tunes,
Have you ever been on a gig and like you fold on your own tunes? It's happened to me.
Oh, yeah.
Like I was so concerned with all the everybody got the charts, like is the book in order? Like, you know, everybody got the details, this stuff. Yeah. And then like I just straight up fold on my own tunes. It's the most
embarrassing
thing. Forget
about that. Yeah. It's like you forget to even 2 hours before the gig, you're like, wait a minute. I can't even play that damn tune. I'm supposed to solo on this tune. I can't even play it. I mean, you know, when you're leading a band, you got to do everything, man.
Everyone's
the drummer's just like, all right, yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Right, they're just waiting for you to call the shots. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you got
to
do everything. So, just getting all that stuff together and dealing with a few other things. How are you? You're out in L.A., right?
I'm out in L.A., yeah.
Whereabouts?
I live in Venice, right by the ocean in Venice.
Nice, man.
Yeah.
Oh, that's got to be awesome.
The weather's cool. The weather's cool. Have you ever been to Venice?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
It's got a grit to it that I'm kind of into.
It's got a vibe, absolutely.
And it kind of is annoying. It's a love-hate relationship.
But you're from the East Coast. I can hear in the accent. You're.
You know what? I'm not, actually. I get that a lot, though. But my ex-wife was a New Yorker. So okay. I think I picked up a lot of that thing from her.
That's funny. I really hear it. I would have sworn you.
She's from Long Island, raised in Brooklyn for her early childhood. So I think some of that, I picked up on some of that over the years.
You're from Chicago. Yeah, from Chicago. Yeah. And been in New York now for, God, it'll be 10 years that I've been here. But
okay.
I still consider myself a Chicagoan. I say I'm a Chicagoan who just resides in New York. Because, you know, Chicago is one of those places. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Chicago's
There's no city loyalty to Phoenix. Like Chicago.
City loyalty. That's the concept.
There's none of that. Like Angelinos have it. Chicago's have it. Chicago people.
Yeah.
New Yorkers. You know, there's so many cities in the States that have it. And Phoenix is just like, I'm from Phoenix. Like, it's not a big deal.
Right. Yeah. I really feel that way with like New Orleans, really big time. Like anybody who ever read from New Orleans, they're, you know, They're a New Orleanser or New Orleanser, New Orleanser, New Orleans person, whatever you would say.
New Orleans,
and they just happen to live, you know, wherever they live. But
right,
you know, I love deep dish pizza. I love the Cubs. Sadly, although this year, you know, what can I do, man? But
all right, so let's put this argument to rest. Chicago guy now living in New York. Where's the best pizza
in New York?
Well, no, between Chicago and New York, it is.
Oh, well, I'm a Chicago pizza guy.
Okay,
yeah, I'm. To me, there's no, you know. I mean, well, look, all pizza is good. I mean, I don't think I've ever had bad pizza, but, you know, I mean, I think even a lot of New Yorkers are starting to admit that while there's you know, an abundance of pizzerias in New York, there aren't that many that are, you know, there are a select few that are exceptional, you know.
Okay.
But I still am a deep dish guy, you know, and so
nice.
That's my thing. But
now I've heard from New Yorkers and Chicago people that, like, kind of the trick to the pizza in both of those cities is the water. That has to do with the waters and, like, the, you know, being so far north that you get a different water situation that changes the vibe. Now, deep dish, that's a pan situation. But other than that, I've always heard it was about the water.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, the concepts are totally different. And most people will tell you that most New Yorkers will tell you that Chicago pizza is not pizza. It doesn't qualify as pizza, that it's actually a quiche or a casserole. Sorry, not quiche, but it's more of a casserole. So they wouldn't even call it pizza. So the concepts are, it is a totally different concept. But Chicago also has its own school of thin crust that a lot of people don't know about. That is in Chicago, they cut the thin crust in squares.
Okay.
Like if you ever go to Uno's is like a chain. There's actually one down the street here.
Okay.
Uno's started in Chicago. It's a chain, but they chop theirs in squares. Hmm. Anyway, so yeah, but I'm a Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago guy.
We're gonna have to start a pizza podcast after we get done here.
Right,
let's just launch one talking about
pizza. LA is the place. Funny, you know, I never realized how serious LA was about its about the deli foods out in LA, you know, until
I started
traveling there. Well, tacos, sure.
Tacos is the thing here. Like, everybody's got their own taco spot. Like, pizza, it's across the board kind of weak here. Like, I'm half Italian from my mom's side. And so, like, finding good Italian food here is a struggle. But tacos, that's the thing. That's what everybody is. Like, they'll vibe you out on where your taco spot is. Like,
wow.
I mean, not. It's a playful vibe, but they're gonna vibe you.
Yeah, there's not a lot of New York is not known for having great Mexican. I think it seems to me that the two foods that New York is kind of weak on is Mexican and Vietnamese.
Mm.
Not good Vietnamese scene here from what I could say. Chicago, I mean, obviously LA in terms of the Asian thing has everything.
Sure.
But Hey, we could keep talking about food all day. Anyways, hey, man, I love what you do. Everything all the content you're putting out, it's amazing, man.
Thanks. As you know, when you're doing the internet thing, it turns into like this other full-time job. And then you realize you're posting and doing all this stuff, and you're like, man, I haven't even practiced in like 2 days. Like, what's going on?
I know.
It's
but I love the way you're focusing on the idea of, you know, focusing on the legends themselves. And
I think that's important, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of a reaction to so many things I did see on the internet, which are a bunch of clickbait and like, you know, five easy licks and all this stuff, like
master the fingerboard, you know, with this, use the this is the universal way to
pyrotechnics going off.
Everyone's obsessed with mastering the fingerboard.
Yeah.
I tell people, I'm like, hey man, just learn how to play some melodies, take some jazz standards, learn how to play some melodies.
Right.
You will play everywhere on the fingerboard, you know, and it's going to be fun. And you're going to make music. And I mean, of course, hey, I'm into everything. But it's funny how.
Yeah, I agree with that one specifically. I think has been really focused on, you know, to a degree that's out of proportion. Yeah. Because like, if you master the fingerboard, like, okay, it's, you know, it's 11 notes that just repeat over and over again. Not a big deal. It's not that hard.
Right.
You know, like, okay. You know, then you start to learn the geometry and like the interval displacement of where they all fall on the instrument. Okay, got it. Now, if you want to learn every scale all over the fingerboard, well, that's something different. That's not the fingerboard at that point. Now you're talking about scales. You know, like just the fingerboard by itself is that's 11 notes.
Yeah. And it's what a drag. I mean, it just sounds like not my whole thing is fun, man. You know, and it's like if it sounds like now again, like you said, maybe it's clickbait, but I just feel like if somebody gives me a matrix, if I see a matrix, it's over.
You know, for me.
If I see a matrix, that's it. I mean, so you know, but but so yeah, it's funny. But yeah, like the man, it's great. Just love what you did with the Jimmy Blanton stuff. It was really interesting.
Oh yeah, man. That's I did this interview for this guy on the East Coast for his show a couple weeks ago, and he was the musical director for Ben E. King, the dude who did Stand By Me.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And he asked me who I thought, you know, were the best bass players of all time. I'm like, dude, there's two. There's Blanton and Jamerson. Done.
Wow.
That's it. There's Blanton and Jamerson. Like everybody else.
That's everybody else came from those.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have those two pillars. Everybody else, you know, all the other guys, Jocko, Wooten, all that stuff. They're still standing on those two pillars. So
That's true.
I think Blanton doesn't get enough love.
Yeah. What was it? Was it you who posted this or somebody else? Maybe it was you, or I'm thinking maybe it was Ben Wolf. Somebody said he asked Ray Brown. Somebody asked Ray Brown, oh, yeah, I bet you learned all of Jimmy Blanton's solos. And he said, I learned the bass lines.
Yeah.
But we know he learned the solos, too.
The connection between Blanton and Ray is deep.
Yeah.
And that's that's another one of those things is going back. I talk about this regularly, going back through the history, and Ray Brown clearly set a standard for what it means to be a jazz double bassist.
Yeah.
But he got his thing from Blanton. Like, if you really want to learn, like learn where they learned, you know, and then Ray took it his way with the huge sound and the bluesy swing thing he did. Okay. But go back to Blanton and find your own voice from Blanton.
Good. That's great. Yeah, that's great.
But not as attractive online as a matrix.
That's right.
The matrix are way more colorful.
And colorful, absolutely.
Yeah, tell me about your boot camp.
Oh, so the boot camp is something I started last year. And actually, I started about a year ago, did my first one. And I started to see, you know, again, well, I'll tell you, just the details of it are it's a 7-week program. Mm-hmm. We meet for a total of 3.5 hours a week.
Okay.
It's a class, essentially.
Okay.
Meaning, you know, there's We meet Mondays are live. You know, Mondays are live.
Yeah.
Everything's live.
Okay.
So Monday is, and it's a 7-week program. Mondays kind of like a shorter, like an hour layout, the things we're going to work on later in the week. Then we come together later in the week on Thursdays. And there's two sessions on Thursdays just for people's schedules, one during the day and one at night. And then those are 90-minute sessions. And then there's smaller groups.
Okay.
And then Saturday is like an office hour sessions. But this time around, this time around, the Monday sessions are recorded.
Okay.
And then the rest is the small group stuff that's live. And then we also have these one-on-one sessions, just because I really felt like my sort of mantra or something I've been thinking a lot about the last year or so with everything is this idea of, the membership communities, which are wonderful. And I just thought, like, you know, man, I love the idea of mentorship. You know, I don't know about membership. I don't know how I'm going to create a membership site, but I think I can mentor some people, you know,
yeah.
and in the way that, you know, that I was always sort of taught. And so it's been fun, you know,
right.
it's been a fun way to, and it's been great for me too, Ryan.
I was going to ask about that. I was going to ask what you've learned, not only from as a teacher, like what you've learned from your students, you know,
yeah.
or like some information to focus on because of reoccurring questions, or how have you grown from going through the boot camp?
Yeah. Well, the way I've done it is it's based on tunes. We're working on standards.
Right.
And the way I've been doing it is it's new every time.
Okay.
So in other words, I'm not just like, you know, redoing the same material. So
sure.
The first time we started with the way we do it is 7 weeks, four tunes. Okay.
Okay.
7 weeks.
Okay.
Two weeks on each tune. And the last week people bring in whatever tune they want to of their own. And we apply all the stuff we learned to that tune.
Love it.
So we work through these standards, and you know, the beauty of studying standards is that there's always more information you can bring to it. So if somebody is a student and they're like, hey, you know, I'm new to jazz, which I've had many people who are like that, and I'm cool just learning the melody. That's a big win for me. If I can play the melody and just move away from just playing everything down here, if I can get up here a little bit and play the melody, that's a win for me. But somebody else is like, hey, I can do all that. I want to transcribe Joe Henderson solo on a record of me, or I want to transcribe, you know, Kenny Durham solo.
Yeah.
My thing is like, I do it with them. You know,
okay.
I'm not the kind of person who like, yes, transcribe that solo and then bring it back to me next week and I will listen to it. I sort of feel like if you're going to do it, part of this, the big thing is that I want to, there's a lot of like, you know, inspiring us is like a group vibe and we're going to make it to, you know, even if you've never played this jazz tune, we're going to get to that 7 weeks together. And so, so I do, you know, do it with them. So it's great. I got to say, I got selfish reasons for doing it too, because
sure.
It keeps my chops up, you know, and it keeps me, I'm a pretty lazy guy, I gotta say. if I don't have real concrete goals and deadlines, I'm not gonna be touching these guys that much.
I think that's pretty normal. And at some point I wanna circle back to that, because if there's no purpose to it, like, why am I doing this? If I can't figure out why, if that question's not answered, I won't do it.
Yeah.
Like, I need some kind of motivator. Like, I'm doing this because, okay, well, then now it has value, so now I'll invest in it. But other than that, like, I'm very similar.
Man, I even, you know, I have this practice guide that I, you know, give out that you can download. And, you know, I quote Leonard Bernstein, who said, I forget the exact quote, but he said something like, creativity is an idea and a deadline.
Yeah.
So like even Bernstein, he was like, hey, if I don't have a deadline, it ain't going to happen, man. You know?
Yeah.
I'm not comparing myself to him at all. I'm just saying.
That can even be applied to just improvising, though. I mean, you have deadlines within the tune. You know, you have cadences that you got to hit and chord changes you got to resolve and a form you got to outline or whatever. Like
touchstones in the tune.
Yeah, that works on the micro and the macro. I like that quote.
Yeah. Yeah, so... So it's great for me because it just helps me to keep my chops up. And it's also, yeah, it's helped me as a teacher. It's been, it's been great. It's helped me to really get a, you know, I think so many people are fantastic players and it's mind blowing. You know, you go on YouTube now, what people are doing on these things is just, it's mind blowing, man. I mean, what, you know, the level is just insane. I'm sure. And you've interviewed many of them. Yeah. And, but being a teacher is a whole other thing. And, you know, sort of having a, not just about, okay, go transcribe that solo and come back to me next week. You know, really kind of helping people to fill in the gaps and put the puzzle together, you know, in a clearer way that, you know, I found is actually quite different. I think really, Ryan, it's like I learned in a way, I think, Jet, the way people are teaching is changing now for the better. But like I learned in the way of like, okay, here's, this week we're working on So What? Here's all your modes. Here's all your scales. You're going to play this scale on this chord, this scale on this chord. I'll see you next week. Go learn how to solo.
Don't get lost in the tune and come back and
go,
7 days.
Go solo and go learn the tune and go make music. And, you know, I tell people that's like saying, here's the alphabet, you know, go become Shakespeare.
Right. Know? Go write the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah. Right.
Here's 26 letters. Go.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been helpful for me to, it's been helpful for me myself too, of like, hey, actually, this is a, if I approach a tune starting here, then starting here, then starting here, then starting there, wow, they're benefiting from that. But I gotta play this tune with my, you know, band on Friday, and I'm using that approach too. And that really made a lot of sense.
Yeah. What is that approach? What's the process of that approach?
Well, you know, it's like the idea is, so like
Let's go through a thing. I want to be the fictitious student. Okay. Here. So I bring in, let me think of a tune that I'll bring in. I bring in Yesterday's.
Okay. Great. Okay. That's one of the tunes we did. We did that.
Oh, great. It's a fun tune.
Yeah. So, first thing is melody.
Okay.
Learn the melody.
Yeah.
Okay. So first thing, week one, bass line and melody. We got to get the basic thing, you know, I call them our background responsibilities and then our spotlight responsibilities. Sure. 'Cause for some people, the spotlight thing, that's a huge leap. Seriously, because a lot of people, they're just used to, and I have a lot of students who they've never studied jazz before. Mm-hmm. And they're playing, you know, I have bass guitar and upright, but definitely more bass guitar students. And, you know, they're living down and, you know, bump, boom, boom, bump, bump. And moving away from that, you know, is that's where they're really stuck, is like, how do I get away from that? So for a student like that, like I said, like learning the melody can be a real big leap. But start with the melody because, like I said, that you're immediately making music. You're immediately, I think, having some fun.
Sure.
And you're immediately moving away from, you know, just playing a bass line.
Yeah.
But of course, so work on bass line, then now first melody, all right? Next thing after the melody, after I tell you all this, no one's going to want to take my phone. But that's okay. Then after
that's where we cut the podcast episode here. For more, go subscribe.
Just hear me going, so the method is... Ryan Roberts Podcast is sponsored by... what I call it, for lack of a better word, just the groupings method, meaning we start with, after a melody, now we just start with single note line, one note. Like a guide tone line, but using one note,
okay,
and two notes, then taking, you know, both our guide tones, so root, you know, third and seventh. Now we create, you know, lines with two notes.
Mm-hmm.
Now we move into three notes, so then now triads. Now, and you know, and then not just from the root, obviously, from you know, from different parts of the chord, and hey, you know, there are cats. If you master triads and know where to put them on different parts of the chords and different parts of the changes, you could kind of just live there if you wanted to.
Right. Who's you would know this from being in New York. Is it Bergonzi that has the triad thing, or is it Garzone that has the triad thing?
One of those guys, but it's definitely sounds like their vibe. It's a very modern saxophone or piano sort of concept, but it's also simple. It's also really, hey, just play three notes, you know, instead of thinking about, then we move into four notes. Four notes is, now we get into, okay, play your chord tones, and now play, and then I have other four note groupings. And then five notes. Now with five notes, we get into our first batch of scales. We get into pentatonic scales.
Mm-hmm.
And pentatonic scales, get really hip because I'm not talking about from the root, you know.
Right.
I'm talking about.
I was gonna say that can get dense too with how.
I'm talking about if I have C minor 7, you know. Like playing G minor pentatonic on C minor 7 or other things like that. So yeah. Now we're into 5-note groupings, then 6-note groupings. 6-note groupings is actually, hey, I just played, I can turn that into a 6-note grouping, turn that into a blues scale, bluesify it. Right? Or and even if you want to get on to now, another internet buzzword, a hexatonic scale. Add a note to that.
I don't even know what it is. I've seen the posts. I don't even know.
I think it's basically, it could be anything. You're just adding one note to your pentatonic scale. And I think what tends to sound best is when you're, now there's Evan Marion, who's a freak. I mean, the guy is mind blowing. And this is his whole system. And I want to get into all that, but it's just basically like, you know, what I think sounds really good is if you take that G pentatonic and you add a ninth to it.
Okay. Now, but to really get into the theory of this, if you're playing a G minor chord thing over a C minor and you add the ninth, which is an A, you're going to shape the color of the minor scale. It could go from natural minor to Dorian with the A flat or an A natural. So is that seventh note a variable? Like, do you adjust it to fit, or is it always a natural nine?
Let me say this first, because Ryan, you're already blowing my mind with theory that I can't even keep up with you, man. Because let me just say this. I just threw the hex. When I talk about 6-note scales, I leave it at the blues scale. All right. Because I do love that sound. Listen, how many times are you like, man, I want to play something bluesy, and you play something and you're like, yeah, no, that wasn't what I was hearing. Yeah. But what I found is, you know, this sort of vibe, that's kind of the vibe, and it's not starting from the root. It's not going to,
right.
It's not that. It's anyways. But the hexatonic thing, yeah, I don't know what Evan, you should interview Evan.
I should. He's on a record with a piano player friend of mine from out here, and I've been meaning to contact him.
Yeah, because it's a fascinating thing. But and then so then six notes. So then after we've done all this, right? And you could, I mean, I'm me personally, I could be challenged just with everything we've talked about, and I could build a language based on everything we've just talked about, and I haven't even gotten to a mode yet.
Right.
So now we get into the 7-note modes, which I think are overrated. I think are
100% agree.
Yeah, I think they're great to learn. First of all, 7 notes, it's not symmetrical. It's just difficult to. They're obviously, for technical purposes, super important to hear modes, to be able to hear what Lydian is, to be able to hear what Phrygian is, super important. And obviously, playing scales on anything is super important. But like, I'm going back to where we just started, which was the way I was taught, which was starting with the modes, you know.
Right.
You're going to play Dorian here, and I'm like, I don't even know how to play a phrase.
You know.
And now you're giving me 7 notes.
Right.
Whereas if you start with like single note, 1 note, then 2 notes, then 3 notes, you're also teaching phrasing, you know? You're limiting. You only have 3 notes to work with. You only have 4 notes to work with. Anyway, so then after modes, then we get into the 8-note scales, bebop scales, and the diminished scales, which to me are infinitely more usable than just your regular 7-note scales. But that's why it is important to learn the modes, because to learn your bebop scales, you kind of do need to, unless you're a Barry Harris acolyte, you really do need to learn those modes. And then that's sort of it, man. That's sort of like the blueprint. But I flip it on its head, as opposed to starting with, even a lot of guys say the first thing is, you know, play chord tones first, you know, 1, 3, 5, 7 through everything. Fantastic. But like, again, let's get even simpler. Hey, let's see how much music we can make just with, you know, a guide tone, just with 1 note.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we have fun with that, and it's been really helpful. you know, for me to codify that method has helped me a lot too. And just like I was saying, in terms of my own practicing, man.
Yeah, that's great, man. So, that's great. And I think I agree with you that, like, I don't really remember, but I feel like modes were, that was the thing. Like, okay, you want to play changes. Well, now we got to talk about modes. Here's Autumn Leaves. It all kind of works together. You know, you got a major tonality and a minor tonality. You know, check out all those modes, but it's kind of all the same, but it's a little different.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, in my mind, like, it's all one thing. Well, like, why? I got a chord? You know, if you're doing Autumn Leaves in G minor, like, okay, well, I got B flat major. Now I just hit these chord tones because otherwise there's no difference. Like the two chord is still the five chord, just with different chord tones. Like, what's the difference? Why do I got to learn all these scales?
Right.
That seems even too much.
Why not just play the major scale?
Yeah. Right.
That just sounds like hipper.
Have some target notes, you know?
I mean, to me, major scale, you know, if I'm playing, you know, if I play, that's hipper to me than.
Right.
I mean, well, I made it kind of hip there, but the idea is, you know,
damn you
to
and
me,
your hipness.
No, I don't mean that, but I mean, if I'm here, hey, at least here I'm starting on C. You know what I'm saying? It's like, why not just play one scale through the whole thing? Why not just play C major scale or a C bebop scale? Because then I get eight notes, you know? Anyways,
it's interesting to me.
Yeah.
And that through all the transcribing I've done and gone back and look at like what they're playing on what chords and stuff, it is not as complicated as an academic approach would make you think it is.
Right.
You know, like I'm wrapping up this Dave Holland solo and I'm going back and checking it out. Like that's not all of what quote unquote jazz education, the mainstream jazz education, whatever that means. Would have you tell, would suggest you have to do to play at that level. Like, it's not, it's not all that hard. And these are the dudes that shaped the sound, you know, like, and they're not doing everything that the jazz machine would suggest you do, which I find really interesting. And so
then I would imagine you've gone to the source with Blanton, man. And so what has that taught you about?
Man, I mean, the first solo break he does, I think I talk about it in the video, is like he plays a D natural minor scale on a D7 chord. So either he just played it because that was the pattern he knew, or he was really trying to get a sharp 9, sharp 13 sound. I don't know. But he came out with, it was just, he wasn't super inside the chord on that one. But it sounds good and it feels good.
Because probably just because his time and his feel are so effing killing.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And he was such a genius.
He could sell it. Yeah.
He could sell it. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, obviously I wasn't there, but everybody's, you know, it seems people say that Bird and, well, clearly, you know, Louis, you know, Armstrong, and he was not thinking about like the double super Locrian scale.
No.
It was
I
have chord tones.
Nine.
Yeah. How am I going to get from, you know, I want to get from here to there. The chord is this. I want to get from here to there. Okay. So I guess I could go, or I could go, hey, that's hip.
Yeah.
I guess it seems like that's what the beboppers were doing, you know, as opposed to thinking about all these scales. And I was going to say, you know, I'm not an acolyte. I can't teach his system. And it's on my list of something that I really want to dig into. But it seems like the Barry Harris system is really where it's at. You know, and he never talked about a mode. I don't think he ever talked about modes.
I don't know how. You know, I've always wanted to talk to guys of an older generation. I would love to talk to Ron Carter about this. And the topic is, how has the institutionalized thing of jazz shaped jazz? Because these schools need people coming in, right? They need to get – the school is a business. They need to keep that business happening. They need repeat customers, blah, blah, blah. Okay. I don't – you know, like – the whole thing with the Bass Shed and me doing the transcribing thing started because I approached Hal Leonard about with this book of a bunch of Miles transcriptions for bass players. And that was because I had a lesson with Petitucci and he had me transcribe this Miles solo. And
wow.
And
which
then I
one?
Went, which one was it? That's a good question. I want to say Autumn Leaves off of okay. What else? Something else.
Yeah.
I want to say that was the one. But then I went down the rabbit hole on that and I started doing these kind of like deep cuts of Dr. Jackal with him on a Jackie McLean record, like yeah, sure. early Miles. Hal Leonard wasn't interested. But after going through all these solos of probably the most famous jazz musician, you know, one of them of all time, you can't find any of that language in that sound.
Right.
You know, now you can find more of a chord scale relationship thing in like a deep bebop guy, but I don't know. I think the institutionalized nature of jazz killed jazz.
You know, it's hey man, it's a really great topic and I never thought about it's funny. I've heard, you know, a lot of interviews with Ron Carter recently and I don't think anybody that would be a great thing to ask somebody like him for sure.
He was there for it, you know.
He was like, there for everything yeah. and it'd be great to hear not only what his take on it is, but like the cats that when you were around, you know, were the Dizzys and the Mileses, were they talking about that stuff or what, right. What were they talking about? Because I mean, again, not to sound, it seemed to my knowledge, and again, I could be totally wrong about this. So everybody out there in podcast world, if I'm wrong about this, I'm sorry, but it seems like the whole codification of all this stuff we're talking about was mostly like a white thing at the North Texas's. And,
that's another one. That's another one I would love to talk
about. I mean,
to
with
Ron
the exception
about.
Of David Baker. David Baker, you know, was a
Indiana.
Big. Yeah, it was a, obviously had a huge role in
jazz theory.
Jazz in codifying all these scales and everything.
Yeah.
But it seems like a lot of it was, you know, the North Texases and the Berkeleys and those kinds of schools. And hey, man, don't get me wrong. I find it for me, it's helpful. I find information and knowledge in anything. But like I don't understand why the altered, you know, why playing the melodic minor scale, you know. On an altered chord, you know, they call that the super Locrian or whatever they call it. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I played with Monty Alexander for a few years, and he didn't know. The guy doesn't know anything about scale. Monty's the greatest piano player on the planet.
Sure.
I remember going traveling with him once, and we were traveling through off the southern coast of Italy, like near and off of Sicily, there it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And there's these islands called the Aeolian Islands.
Okay.
And of course, you know, what musician isn't going to go there and you know, make a dumb joke about, you know, hey, you know, I guess they must love the Aeolian vibe, yeah, 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 scale around right, here, right, you know?
Yeah.
And he was like, what's that? What is that? I was like, you know, scales, it's natural minor. He's like, yeah. What do you mean natural minor? What's that?
Yeah.
But he's sort of unique because he's just hearing he can hear anything. But anyways, it's a trip. And I find that it's confusing. It confuses many students who have come to me or, you know, in the boot camp or whatever. They're confused by all of it, man. It's like there's too much. There's so much of this information out there. And it's almost like, you know, what do they say? The paralysis of analysis. There's too much. You know, there's too much, and people are like, I just don't know where to start with all this.
Right,
you know?
It's completely overwhelming, and then it's like, why bother? Like, I'll just go back to playing, you know, Songs by the Cure.
So like, that's why, you know, it's cool what you're doing because it's like, hey man, just go right to the source. You know,
transcribe
a Ray Brown solo. You know, and start there. Forget about all this other nonsense, and you know, transcribe that solo.
I think it's just a language. You know, like if to really learn the vocabulary, because there's a generation of bass players, and I don't know if I can really go back and say when I got aware of it. I got aware of it the older I got, actually. Like the further back I started listening to like older dudes, you realize jazz guys or bass players that are improvising technically at a super high level don't have the vocabulary. So like, well, when did we learn the vocabulary? Like, when did we lose the vocabulary? I don't exactly know. But I think that every genre has a vocabulary. If you're playing country, that has a vocabulary.
Yeah.
If you're playing jazz, that has a vocabulary. If you're playing reggae, that has a thing. Because it's very much to me, like, you've traveled a lot playing the bass. And so, you know, when you go to these other lands, they have their own language and right. they have their own culture. And every genre of music is a check-in with that culture. You go to Vietnam or you go to Russia or you go wherever, they have their own dialect, they have their language. And I think genre is the same way. It's like being really proficient, you know, in French and then going to Brazil or something. Totally. It's like, okay, you're not speaking the language of this thing. And I think that there needs to be a language associated with every time you play a style.
Right. And there's and there's no shortcuts to it. I mean, it's
there isn't. No,
you know, it's there are. There, yeah, it's funny. There are. You know, what I say to some people is like, there's no shortcuts, but I may be able to show you a few things that I just say I wish that somebody had told me. You know,
I agreed. Yeah,
20 years ago to make it clearer so that you can at least get there a little faster. You know, in other words, if somebody had told me, you know. 30 years, you know, whatever, when I was just started playing that, just think of minor 7 flat 5, you know, C minor 7 flat 5 is just E flat minor triad over C. That's all it is.
Yeah.
That would have made my life so much easier. And I'm, you know, I'm not, I don't know, I never saw it that way. And I never, you know, I play a little piano now, but I didn't start. I think if I had like started playing piano at a very young age, I would have seen that, like that would have been clear
visually,
to me,
right?
You know, because if you're a piano player, all that stuff is just it's that's how you're voicing things, and it's very clear to you.
Yeah.
But I think so. Like, yeah, there's no shortcuts, but there are ways of, you know, understanding things that that can make it quicker. I mean, just to, you know, like one, and again, I'm not a Barry Harris expert, but his whole concept of, breaking chords into a sixth chord over a root. That opened up my whole life, man.
Okay.
Like the idea of, anyways, similar to the other thing, but like instead of thinking about C major 7 as this huge structure, you know, think G major 6th over C.
Okay.
And anyways, for my brain, that was like, wow. That makes things so much easier for me. And then his whole system is you can break all these chords down into just six chords, either major 6 or minor 6 over a root. Mm-hmm. And that to me was like, man, I wish somebody had told me that years ago, because that would have made things so much easier for me.
And then going, well, you're playing a tune or learning a tune, or whether this is now or when you were coming up, and you started to kind of superimpose this mindset on learning changes. When you're walking, you want to check in with the root more, but then when you're soloing, do you just solo over that upper chord and to kind of leave space for the root?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, for instance, I gave this webinar a few months ago and I the whole theme was, moving away from the root. Because obviously, we got to take care of business as bass players first. You know, that's, we got to be able to groove our butts off and swing our butts off and play in the pocket. That's rule number one. If you can't do that, that's where you got to start. But it's like, okay, let's say, you know, you're doing pretty good at that and you're ready to now take a solo. So then, like you're saying, and we were sort of talking about earlier, then for many bass players, it's like, okay, how do I now move away from the root? Mm-hmm. And we're so sort of tied to it, but you know, when I, like, for instance, when I heard about that method, it just made it so clear to me, because I had talked to piano players through the years and they were always seeing chords in that way, you know, seeing chords as even more complicated chords as, oh man, it's really just this over this. And I'd be wow. All right. Yeah. I never saw that because.
Right. Like a sus chord is just 2/5.
Yeah. Or, C major 7 sharp 5 is just an E triad over C.
Right.
You know, and there are things like that. And even progression, seeing like actually, this is just disguised 2-5-1. You know, it may seem like it's all these chords here. Anyway, so
It's all just a blues. The whole thing is it's all just a blues. It's all whatever.
Yeah. But I just found that, yeah, when you start thinking that way, yes, then it's like, okay, hey, if let's say we just have C major, or let's say we have C minor for a long time, because Barry's concept is then on a minor chord, you play on C minor, you go to the minor third, and you play a major sixth from the minor third. So C minor would be E flat major sixth over C. Sure. It makes perfect sense, right? That's cool. It doesn't give us any color or anything, but at least still it's like, oh, okay, wow. I don't have to think about the root, you know? If I'm soloing, hey, I can just do a lot with that triad. So, it's helped me, and that sort of approach, again, I think it's less common for bass players to be taught that way and to think that way.
Yeah. I'd agree. That's like some horn guy stuff, you know, like really getting inside, like putting all these chords and layering and.
Yeah. It can be challenging for some students though, because there is a benefit. And for some people, I've seen some pushback on teaching this way, because for some students who may not have any familiarity with chords, they can't go there. They can't. Sure. It's too much information. Now they're trying to understand one thing over another thing.
Right.
And it can complicate it.
The problem they could run into is they think that they have to think about it that way. Well, if I don't wrap my head around this idea, then I won't be able to do that thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is just a suggestion of an approach.
Right.
Which I wish, maybe you would agree, that I wish I would have been told that. Like, you can improvise in so many different ways. Here's a bunch of different like approaches. You could take more of a modal approach to playing changes. You know, that's a thing. You can get into the bebop thing and like a lot of arpeggios and upper structure notes. That's a thing. But it doesn't have to be this to equal that. Like there's so many different avenues to that. And I know part of your boot camp is unlocking a personal voice. And so do you help coach or instruct or direct students into these different approaches to find what they gravitate to? If they're more of a lyrical player, all right, maybe check out more of a modal thing.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of the real focus of the boot camp is, you know, it's called the touching bass boot camp. And it's like the idea of touch points. You know, I'm trying to I like working, you know, just interacting with people. And so, yes. So we have these private sessions and these either in lessons or in these just private weekly sessions. And I'm always assessing, you know, where somebody, like, in other words, I had a lesson today where I was telling somebody, you know, you don't have to think so literally about everything. That's something that I see a lot of.
Yeah.
Not quite answering your question, but it's inspiring.
Sure.
Going off on a little tangent it's something that confused me for a long time, because I would hear, you know, great soloists that I admire and great soloists, and I'd say, man, how are they getting away with playing that note on that chord, you know?
Yeah.
Or even when you said about, you know, Jimmy Blanton, you know, okay, how is he getting away with doing that? And so many students will come to me and they'll be like, hey, they would transcribe something like that and be like, why? How did he do that? You can't do that, you know? And I'm like,
right.
I'm like, you know what? Yeah, it's not part of the chord, but you're just going to roll through it for a quick second. You know, you're probably not going to, like, you know, on this C major seventh chord, you're not going to lay on that F, right? But, you know, if you play, you know, it's in that scale, and that's okay. You don't have to feel so literal. Like, it's going to be in there, and you're going to hear so many players where they're not thinking, you know, so literally in that way. But my thing with everybody, man, is it's like, you gotta play melodically, you know?
Yeah.
You gotta play stuff that start super simple, and don't worry about all, so many people, and this is kind of gets back to what you're saying, but so many people, they feel like they want to put together all these scales, they want to put together all this stuff, but they've never, I'm like, hey, have you just tried taking the melody and just soloing off the melody. You know, the notes in the melody work great. Yeah. You know, the notes of the melody of Stella have survived thousands of years because they ring so beautifully, you know, on that, you know, all that, you know. Those notes ring and sound excellent until you're really ready to start, you know, hey, man, you know, whatever, Mr. Student or lady, student, until you're really ready to get triads and all that stuff. Do you know how much you can do just by rhythmatizing those melody notes or just singing, you know, singing those, trying to sing those notes in a beautiful way? So, yeah, I mean, I feel like what I try to do is it's not, even though the everything I gave you is a lot of materials, but it's like kind of what we're saying. I'm trying not to bombard them with, you know, 9 million scales and 9 million approaches and 9 million everything, which is one of the kind of a problem that I see with online education. It's like everything for everybody, you know, more. Yeah. Here's everything. You want this, we got this, you want 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 this. Come into my digital world and I've got everything you need, man.
Right.
You can have this and this person and this person, and this person. As opposed to that, it's like, hey, you know, there's nothing unhip about just playing a melody.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
That is never going to be unhip.
No, you know? Not at all. And like what you do with it, like there's a friend of mine here in LA that moved here from New York a couple of years ago. And he did some road work with Branford Marsalis back in the day. And one thing he learned from Branford was like everything you need to solo is already in the tune.
Yeah.
Like, and so this piano player is brilliant at never really losing the nature of the melody or the tune when he solos. Like it's all there. You don't have to interject all this, you know, up a minor third, now we're doing this and like all this. And some people, that's their thing, you know, and that's whatever. I'm sure it's a reflection of how they think about the world, their energy. If they're an intense person, they're going to play intensely.
Yeah.
This guy, Roy, he's laid back. And so he plays this really laid back, musical, lyrical thing. And it's all right there. He never loses the nature of the tune. And I think that that is so important. And playing with him regularly, I learned that from him, is it's all there. You can learn all this stuff. And that's cool to have in your toolbox.
Right.
But everything you need, like you were saying, it's already there. You're playing Stella, like, cool. Let's really check out, if you just take that half step, the very beginning of the melody, what can you do with that half step throughout the whole form? Yeah. You know, where can you find those little half steps? They can really outline some things, you know, and then you're progressing on what's already been stated. I agree with all that. That's
It's funny. It's just that you reminded me of something I was thinking about the other day. I have this gig, you know, on Friday, and it's you know, I don't get a chance to lead a gig very often, but and so, you know, originally I'm like, all right, man, I'm gonna play all my original tunes, and I'm gonna play this tune, I'm gonna play this tune. Yeah, man, I'm gonna send them all the tunes, and I was like, you know what? I just want to swing, man. I just want to play some standards, and there's this voice in the back of my head that's like, oh, you know, you can't do that. That's not hip enough. Yeah. And I was like, you know what, man? There is nothing unhip. Now, I'm not saying I can do this successfully, but there is nothing unhip about just playing a tune with beautiful time and like a beautiful groove, you know, like and swinging and whatever it is. It doesn't have to be this like magical. It doesn't have to be this epic statement.
Right.
And like there's anyway, so that for me was like kind of just along the lines we're talking about. It's like there's nothing unhip about just, hey, I guess just all comes down to this, keep it simple, man.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, stupid. You know? That's what I always have to tell myself.
What standards did you land on? What standards
It's funny, man, because I think, and the cats don't know this yet, and I'm hoping they're not going to look at me and be like, what? Summer Wind, man.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a great one.
I'm sorry. I'm like, I was listening to that the other day. We were having dinner and Frank tune came on and I was like, God damn. I mean, of course we all have horrible memories of playing that tune on countless weddings and all that, whatever. But then I was listening to Ray's trio play it, you know, and I was like, man, you know what? this is, I love this tune.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to play this tune on Friday.
Yeah. No, that's good.
I haven't told the guys that yet. And I'm afraid that they may be like, what? I don't want to play that damn tune. But that's when I'm thinking to myself, hey, man, there's nothing wrong with just playing a simple tune like that. Anyway, so like, I want to play that. I want to play When Lights Are Low.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to play even just like Speak Low. Just some standards. And they're simple standards. I mean, we are playing some of my harder originals, but that's part of it, too. It's like I hate gigs. Like my thing is, I don't hate gigs. I should have said that. I hate gigs. That's awesome. You're going to use that as the opener. Lauren Cohn says, I hate gigs.
Now I'm going to use that. Now that you announced it.
That was the worst place I ever put a pause after the word gigs. Oh my God. You have to edit that out. That's hilarious.
I can guarantee it won't be the opener, but man. Yeah,
that's awesome.
It would have been.
What I meant was, I hate gigs where everyone's head is buried in music.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's so often, you know, and there's a time and a place for that. But it's like, to me, there's just a beauty of like, hey, this piano player has never played with this drummer before. Let's just see what happens, man. Let's just have some fun and like look at each other and play a real simple tune and just see what happens here. As opposed to, and yeah, let's do some, you know, some maybe trickier things too. But I love that feeling of like, hey, this guy's never played with this guy before. Let's play Summer Wind.
Yeah, yeah.
And just see what happens, man. You know? And anyway, so it just coming back to this idea of simplicity and, you know, and relishing in that and just just enjoying that, you know.
Yeah, I always had an idea of doing a record of calling people I've never played with. And then just like no rehearsals, no nothing. Just like four people, whatever, three, whatever, doesn't matter. Just go put up mics and call tunes and document the process musicians go through when they're playing with somebody they've never played with before. And like just hit record once and call tunes and like try to capture the evolution of musicians getting comfortable with each other. Because that's always, now I'm sure, you know the musicians you're playing with on your gig. But there is that thing of like settling into it, just playing something that we all know to learn the other person is fascinating to me. And it's a different, I don't know about challenge. It's something else to be aware of.
That's the beauty of jazz. You know, that's what makes jazz fun. And I think for me personally, I had a teacher who was, who had this thing of like the set must always be, every tune has to be presented in the most original way imaginable. And, and it's got to be an original or an arrangement, and it's got to be something new that the audience hasn't heard before. I mean, that's wonderful. If you have a band where you guys are working out original compositions and you're doing it all the time, that's wonderful. But you know what? I also love the exactly what you're saying and kind of what we're talking about. I love just like, hey, man, the beauty of jazz is these guys have never played before and they're smiling. You can tell they're digging, playing with each other. And let's just see what happens right now.
Yeah.
I guess it could go the other way too, where they're not smiling.
It can definitely tank. We've all been on those gigs and sometimes I've been the one to tank it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. But I enjoy that. And, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but, watch, I'll call you on Saturday. I'll be like, man. I called Summer Wind, bro. And
remember that time I said I hate gigs?
Yeah, I got laughed out of the room. Yeah, I really do hate gigs now. Yeah, I made a dumb move. Yeah. I will say this, Ryan, and this is pretty funny, because I got this idea last night. It's not an idea. It's nothing that interesting. It's actually the most simple thing. I was like, hey, let's play Summer Wind. And I was like, you know what? Before I tell them, I'm going to sleep on it.
Okay. A little nervous to bring it to the table.
I'm going to sleep on it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times I'll find that in the evening I get ideas and in the morning I wake up and I'm like, what the?
Yeah, God, that wasn't the best. It
happens with a lot of things with us in the evening where we get these ideas, right? But actually today I still felt good about it. So I think we'll be playing that. But
man, there's a beautiful record and I'm trying to remember who did the record. But they did all Richard Rodgers tunes. And So material-wise, it's just a collection of standards. But the way they played these standards and really got inside – who was it? I think Jay Lionheart was on bass, Bill Stewart on drums. Mm-hmm. I just can't remember the piano player whose record it was.
Yeah.
But, man, there's a – it's just a different skill set, you know, to really play standards and get inside the tune. And you can go yes. one of two ways of it. You can take, like, the Miles 60s approach with what are we going to do with this and how can right. we flip it upside down? Or how can we get so inside My Funny Valentine to really sell this and the lyrics of this without a singer? Can we convey the lyrics without a singer, you right. know, and really get deep into it? I think that's a different art form. And a different yeah. skill set that's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, those guys had the benefit of, you know, working, you know, three sets a night for, you know, 11 months out of the year.
Right.
It, which definitely, I think, helped that
yeah, of
that
course.
Simpatico thing. But yeah, it's funny, man. It's like the older I get, as much as I love writing music and I love composing music, but I find a lot of joy in just, hey, man, let's just, you know, have some fun and play some tunes. And it's funny because, you know, in New York or LA, or you go to, you know, where there's city places where there are great musicians, you'll go in, you could go down to wherever, you know, I don't know, the clubs in LA, and you could hear a Bill Cunliffe, right? I say yeah. that because I think he lives out there.
Yeah, he does.
And you could hear him, he'd sit down and play Summer Wind, and you would never even question why yeah. anybody wouldn't want to play that tune, right?
Right.
Because you'd be like, that was so beautiful and so perfect. That was amazing. I love yeah. that. You yeah. know? And like, the point is, like, a great musician can make something that we may think is kind of trite. They can, you know, they can bring out. I'll go hear Dave Kukowski here in New York, and he'd play a tune like that, you know, or he'll play simple little tunes. And, well, because he's who he is, and he's, you know, he's such a brilliant cat. But I think, you know what it is? And then I'll shut up. I think it's because no, I think it's because somebody like him or a Bill Cunliffe or guys like that, they understand they're rooted in, you know, the tradition in the same way that you're talking about Jimmy Blanton. They're rooted in those people that gave us that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, with the music. As opposed to, yeah, maybe if I went and heard some kid who just graduated from Manhattan School and who can play the claves and every different thing.
Right, he's gonna play Summer Wind in five, you know. Eighth note equals 280.
Yeah, maybe if I heard him play Summer Wind, probably, you know, maybe wouldn't do the same thing to me. It's just like, I guess when I'm listening for those tunes, I'm listening for the love, you know. I want that love. I want to feel that, you know. So anyways,
yeah,
that's where my head is at these days.
That's great, man. I think I agree with all that, and that all of that, you know, whatever the material is, still playing the humanity of the tune, you know. If you're in it and you're doing that thing, whether it's Summer Wind, I mean, I think that there's still a couple songs that like should never be played.
I hear you.
Blue Bossa? No.
I hear you.
Let's just
yes.
take it out of the whole lexicon. Take yeah. it out of the real book. We're done with that one.
I hear you. I hear you. I just, yeah.
But some of the older tunes, man, like it's cool because you just, at this day and age, the jazz is a vehicle for improvisation and artistry. I mean, that's what it's always been, is artistry. So you're kind of just looking for something else to blow on now. I think we could probably all thank Coltrane for that.
Yeah.
But if you can really tap into like the tune and do that, who cares what it is? If it's beautiful and it moves somebody, that's amazing. I mean, how yeah. many times did, you know, Bill Evans record, you know, Remember a Person I Knew or Emily, or, you know, he had this kind of select playlist that he was always working from. So often, right. but he was exploring new things in it and pulling more out of yeah. the tune.
Totally.
Which is, you know, the working guys. Now we just have to know like 7 million tunes in every key.
Right.
And you don't really get anywhere because all those like old bands, like when there was a band of guys, like they had their tunes that they did and they found new corners in. And I think there's something to that as well. It's not.
Yeah.
Having to know like the hippest thing or do the hippest arrangement or just extract yeah. some new music out of something that's familiar.
Yeah, man. And I think that's, you know, that's the beauty of playing jazz is that, yeah. You know, we can go back to these tunes. I mean, even, yeah, man, just when you think about the lyrics, of some of these tunes, it's just, you know, I'm a romantic at heart. And so they, yeah. I still kind of, I think I was an old, you know, I think I lived in Palm Springs in the past. I think I was an old Jewish guy in Palm Springs, you know, in some past life.
Sounds amazing.
But anyways, man.
Let's quickly talk about your record. You did your record in 2015. Oh, I like the instrumentation you have on the record.
Thank you.
I personally like vibes with upright bass. Like, I got a vibes player on my record.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Who's on your record?
A vibes guy that was in New York for a while. His name's Nick Mancini.
Okay.
He was out here for a long time, and now he's not out here anymore.
Nice.
The instrumentation on the record is drums. I play electric and upright, vibes, and bass clarinet.
Oh, nice. Nice, yeah, man.
So, so when I saw your record and the instrumentation on your record, I liked it. I liked that you went some other places than just choosing a standard jazz quartet or quintet instrumentation.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Where did some of those ideas come from? Were those led by the material, or did you have the band in mind and then chose material for the band? Which one came first?
I had the material, but my music doesn't, for some reason, most of my music doesn't sound great on horns.
Okay.
And I don't know why that is, but I accept it now. It's cool.
I personally just want to blame horn players. Like, the music's probably fine. Let's just blame the horn player.
I hear you, man. Yeah. We don't need them anymore.
No.
But I've always loved mallet instruments, and I was always a huge fan of Joe Locke. And then because I grew up with Jaco and hearing those records with Jaco and Othello and all the steel pan stuff, I loved that sound and always dreamed of wanting to do something with steel pan.
Yeah.
And it took me coming to New York and kind of just discovering a whole new set of musicians on the East Coast. To find, you know, somebody, a guy named Victor Provost, who's, you know, is like the Michael Brecker, the steel pan. Wow.
Yeah.
So when I found him, and then so mallets, I just felt like, man, my tunes sound good with mallets, and these are two guys who will tear the crap out of these tunes,
right.
Which they did, and then. So it's funny, you know, I mean, like, I thank you for that, because I think some people were like, steel pan and harmonica? What? You know?
Yeah.
I never questioned it, because, again, I will admit, hey, steel pan and harmonica, I mean, Jaco and Toots, that sound is ingrained. That's what brought me to jazz, and, like, that's just ingrained in my DNA. And, again, there's a guy here, Yvanik Prine, who's, again, he's like the Michael Brecker of the harmonica. Mind-blowing. So, you know, when I encountered those guys, I was like, oh, wow, actually, these tunes would sound good with them. But, I mean, Joe Locke can make it, you know, he can make anything sound amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm kind of a frustrated. I would love to play vibes. I wish I had. I just love the instrument so much.
Yeah? Yeah?
I think it's sort of the ultimate jazz instrument. You know, I think it's... It's obviously has the African connection.
Mm-hmm. There's clearly a European connection to it.
It's Africa and Europe coming together. You're hitting something.
Yeah.
It's percussive, but it also makes sound. It's like, that's, you know, I love that. And somebody like Joe just gets such a beautiful sound. That's something that blew me away too. How these guys can, you know, just take a mallet and hit a piece of brass.
Yeah.
And get like a real vocal quality with it. So that was kind of,
Were you a fan of those old records with the Modern Jazz Quartet and Milt Jackson? And like, have you always been really into vibes?
Yeah, always. Okay. I know you're a Ray freak like I am. So Ray and Milt Jackson, all those records that they did together. When I first started getting into Ray Brown, I was listening to all those records. And then when I was... I was a huge Monty Alexander fan before I started playing with him.
Okay.
And of course he has a long association with Milt Jackson as well. So that sound was always like, when I was getting into jazz, the sound of the vibes was part of it. And then when I connected with Joe Locke, then that was like, okay, he's like the greatest living vibes player on earth. And that was, then it was like, all right, man, I don't know. I'm just meant to play with vibe players somehow.
But, it's fun. It's fun. I think that there's one thing I like about it is it doesn't have the same range as a piano. So they're not in your territory, you know, like the piano, you know, the piano player can like get a little courageous with the left hand and all of a sudden he's in your thing.
It's a major piece of furniture, man.
Yeah. So yeah. Vibes, and it sits on top of the double bass really nicely.
Yeah.
I think I initially got into that relationship through Dave Holland Records.
Right. Absolutely. That connection too with Steve Nelson.
Yeah. And then going back and listening to Milt Jackson, and have you heard the Milt Jackson record with Ray Charles?
Oh, yeah.
Man, I just found out about that record like 3 years ago, and I was texting everybody. Like, if you knew about this, why didn't you tell me about it? That's You're not my ridiculous. Friend if you knew about this record and you didn't tell me, because that record That's is unbelievable.
I have a friend who my best friend is Bob Cranshaw's nephew through marriage.
Okay.
Peter Curtis, he actually lives out on the West Coast. His aunt married Bob.
Okay.
And in any event, so, and Bob was with Milt Jackson for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And when Peter's a great guitarist out there. And when he was thinking about where he wanted to go to school, he came to New York and he was hanging out with Bob and Milt Jackson. And he asked Milt, he said, you know, Milt, I'm thinking about going to Berklee College of Music. What do you think? And Milt said, they can't teach you what I got. I love that, man.
Yeah, he's not wrong.
Anyways, but yeah, it's like the embodiment of the blues, man.
Yeah, it's deep, man. And I think that to continue to go back to jazz culture versus jazz academia, there's that relationship, like how the blues came from that church culture,
right?
And there's an ethos there that permeated the jazz. now I'm a 60-year-old Jewish man living in living in Palm Springs too. But yeah, there's a thing there about there's a relationship to music and community and to culture that comes from that lineage that is not in school, you know, and it came from
Detroit. It was all Detroit, man. I mean, Detroit was the place. That was where, talking about Jamerson.
Yeah.
I mean, I know everybody talks about New Orleans, and absolutely New Orleans was where, you know, American music was kind of born. But when it comes to, you know, modern American music, you know, both, I mean, just you think about Motown, it always blows my mind that all those musicians were just in Detroit.
Yeah.
You know, from Jamerson to Diana Ross to, you know, Smokey Robinson, they all just happen to be in Detroit. But then you've got, you know, Bags, Milt Jackson in Detroit, Ron Carter in Detroit, you know, Barry Harris in Detroit, the Joneses brothers in Pontiac, Michigan. I mean, that's all. It's the idea of community and man, that's you get to find it in, you know, that's where and they were all just hanging out with each other, it seemed like, and just, you know, and studying and playing. And
I think, crazy. I mean, there's a couple other cities like that. Philadelphia has a deep connect, like a bunch of dudes came out of Philly. Yeah. You know, they all gravitate towards New York. And there's something I'm always captivated by, the geography of sound.
Yeah.
You know, because each place has a sound, you know, like. I'm sure you recognize it from moving from Chicago to New York, that the cats in New York play differently. There's a sound there that reflects the city. You know, in LA, it's sunny here all the time. It's 75 degrees all the time. And it's just a feel good town. And so like the groove thing, you know, is a big deal out here because that reflects the weather. And those things are always really interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I think one of the reasons I fell in love with Monty Alexander, for instance, he's from Jamaica. And so his whole vibe is like, when he sits down and plays a chord at the piano, you hear the sunlight, man. I hear the sun. I hear the ocean. I mean, I'm serious, man. It's like, I've done things. We did some things where, like, you know, it was Monty, and then another super, super famous piano player who, like, I'm not even going to name mention. It was unreal. But you would hear both people at the sound check. Monty would just sit down and play one chord, and it was like the light just opened up, man.
Yeah.
Just the heavens opened up, and all that just came in, and something about that drew me to his music. And it's funny because, like, yeah, man, but totally. I mean, like, I think Chicago has always been associated with, like, you know, a soulful blue collar city, big shoulders, blah, blah, blah.
Working class industry.
Working class, you know, and so the music, it's got that, you know, the tough Wilbur wear or the blah, blah, blah.
Right, or just the shuffle. Like, when I think of Chicago, I just think of a shuffle. Like, you know, and we're just doing that. Or Jim Croce. Like, I'm a huge Jim Croce fan. So
Is he from Chicago?
I think so. I think so.
I didn't know that.
But he's it's that same thing. It's like this blue collar poet, you know, even in Jim Croce. And it's like, so there's that industry or industrialization in the sound that I think of when I think of Chicago. You could speak to it better than I can, obviously.
Yeah. And then, in New York, you have, again, people here from everywhere. I feel like things have changed quite a bit because over the last few years, we've lost so many of the jazz legends. And I also think, you know, with COVID now, a lot of people have stayed in New York, but a lot of people move. The scene is, it's spread out now. It's like, of course, New York is always going to be New York, but, like, I've been amazed to see the movement to LA over the last 10 years.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I hear about it regularly, like dudes moving from New York here, and then dudes that were here, they're like, they're going somewhere else. You know, like, guys from New York are coming in, and then, like, dudes who've been in LA for a while, they're Nashville or Austin, or they're...
Right.
Especially with COVID, because a lot of like pop touring guys are like, man, there's no work. I don't need to be here.
Right. If people moved away, I have, you know, I mean, like, Tel Aviv, Israel. You know, well, if you come to New York, you know, I mean, you know, every fourth musician you meet is from Israel. Like, there's something in the water there that they're producing, you know, if I hear another Israeli bass player who makes me want to, there's so many ridiculous Israeli bass players in this city, it's mind blowing, but they're on every instrument.
Sure.
But so a lot of people moved back to Tel Aviv because they were like, hey man, Tel Aviv scene is, it's not New York, but it's pretty unbelievable.
Sure.
And then, you know, sort of like, I'm just going home.
Yeah.
You know, or people are like, screw it, I'm moving back to Chicago, or, you know, going wherever they were. I mean, the LA thing was interesting because it seemed like there was the blue whale.
Sure.
And it seemed like that really was
spot, that was kind of, that was kind of the, you know, flagship club in LA for a while. And before that, there's been, like, I mean, when I moved here, Lava Lee was still a big one. That's more like a baked potato fusion club.
Right.
You know, you can go out there and hear Haslip or whatever, Gary Willis, whatever.
But it seemed like it was more on the fusion side of things. But since the blue whale, it's been more of, like, you know, not only more experimental stuff, but a lot of, you know, more straight ahead, you know, stuff going on. And it's been interesting to see that happen too out there.
Yeah. There's a couple clubs still. I think some popping up, and there's some that are moving more towards the forefront. One, it's good that it's not just the one club, you know. But the Blue Whale was kind of a magical place. Like that, I really liked that place. Did you ever get a chance to play there?
I played there once. Okay. Yeah, it was awesome. And I just know that, you know, followed it through the years and just found it interesting how it seemed to be a real center of a lot of stuff going on between whether it was, like I said, the straight ahead thing or then all the Lewis Cole, the satellite, the groups of all that genre, whatever you want to call that, you know, thing happening out there. And
it was really focused on artistic stuff all the time. You know, it was really like a legit art space.
Yeah.
And the owner, June, who's a jazz singer, like he was obviously...
Was he a musician? I didn't even know he was a musician. Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah, he was a singer.
Gotcha.
Yeah, he was a sweetheart. I remember when that club opened up, I emailed him and I'm like, hey, man, and it was super new and it hadn't been like it hadn't become the whale yet. And I'm like, yo, man, I'm thinking about doing this idea of like, you know, getting a bunch of people together. And I was listening. I was doing a lot of flying and I was listening to podcasts of the Brooklyn Jazz Underground.
Oh, yeah.
Which I don't even know if that's still around. Mark and Alan Ferber were in it.
I think they moved back to L.A. or I think Mark's back in L.A.
Mark's back here. And I got a chance to play with him. And I told him about all this. And then that inspired me to like, wow, I want to do something like that in L.A. And like, hey, June, man, I got this idea. Do this like kind of L.A. collective thing. And then maybe like, you know, whatever. The second or third Thursday of a month. Like, let's just have another group from the collective come in and like really make it a community thing. And he was cool with the idea, but we were all just still trying to figure out how to make it work, and it never happened. But he was always really cool to me, and every time I'd go down there, he was a sweetheart, and you know, I'd be at the door like ready to pay him a cover, and he's like, "Nah, man, just come on in, like whatever." And he was, I missed the club, and it was a good hang. I like that place.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for taking the time to do this, and thanks again for being.
Thank
flexible.
You, Ryan. Yeah. Hey, man, thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure.
Right, that was my talk with bassist Lauren Cohen. Again, check out his bass boot camp. I'm really into it. I really like his approach to jazz education and keeping things simple and not diving into like learn all the modes, learn, you know, all this stuff. It's just so overwhelming when you start jazz. It took me years and years. And I'll let you know if I ever get to the end of it. just years to figure out like, okay, this is what I want my voice to be within this music. But always kind of just, you know, chasing this thing of like, I have to do that. If I want to play jazz, I have to do that. Then I have to do that. Okay, well, this guy doesn't do that. But then everybody else, all these books are talking about this. You know what I mean? Like, I never like sat down. I tried multiple times to like sit down and actually learn 2-5 licks, major and minor and all that stuff. It's not for me. That was too just kind of sterile. And so I really like Lauren's approach to it, which is just starting with information that's in the tune, starting with the melody, playing melodies, start with one note, start with two notes and move from there. And look for changing tones with guide tone lines and things like that. All fantastic approaches, which streamline the process. So you're not overwhelmed by what the marketplace for jazz has made jazz. That is a much different conversation that maybe at some point I'll expound upon. But for right now, that's enough. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Give it a rating. There's going to be some new things coming down the pike from the Bass Shed. So, you know, do the social media thing, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that. I'll be talking about it all. That's what I got for this one, folks. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.